Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, aerial dance maker Jo Kreiter talks about her latest work, which takes on the issue of wage security for women. It's created for the outdoor space Continuum Alley on Golden Gate Avenue and completes a trilogy of such public performances. I'll also talk with a Susanna from Alabama who comes to us not with a banjo on her knee, but with a beautiful operatic soprano voice, which she brings to Davies Symphony Hall, where I visited with her earlier this week. She'll be singing Barber's Knoxville Summer of 1915 with the San Francisco Symphony this afternoon, and then Friday and Saturday evening. I'll also have a discussion with Michelle Hayner and composer Dan Cantrell, who collaborated on The Unheard of World at the Exit Theater. And a little later, well, does this voice sound a little bit familiar? Have a listen.
What a difference a day made. 24 little hours brought the sun and the flowers.
Listen closely as there are some serious genetics at work there. I'll talk with Frank Sinatra Jr. later in the hour. He's performing next week at the Wells Fargo Center in Santa Rosa. Peter Robinson will also stop by with a couple of film reviews, so do stay with us. Jo Kreiter's Flyaway Productions unveils the third and final installment in its trilogy about urban poverty to a score by Teresa Wong, set and rigging design by Sean Riley with lighting design by Matthew Antaki and costumes by Miranda Caroline. Needles to Thread runs starting today for 12 free performances through October 10th outdoors in San Francisco's Continuum Alley, located at the intersection of Dale Place and 255 Golden Gate Avenue. I last talked with Jo about the second work in her trilogy, Multiple Mary and Invisible Jane, which explored the growing population of older homeless women living on the streets of San Francisco, as did my colleague Rose Aguilar for your call. And this final installment, Needles to Thread, expands the trilogy's focus from housing security to wage security. Jo Kreiter is a choreographer with a background in political science. Through dance, she engages imagination, physical innovation, and the political conflicts that we live within. Her lineage includes gymnastics, Chinese pole, acrobatics, and 14 years as a principal dancer with Joanna Haygood. Awards for Jo Kreiter Flyaway Productions include two Isadora Duncan Dance Awards, a 2013 Center for Cultural Innovation Award, and an Artist Investigator Award from Cal Shakespeare. Jo, welcome back to KLW.
Thanks for having me back.
And thank you also for your contribution earlier in the day as part of Morning Edition and your recommendation for other arts-related happenings here in the Bay Area.
Well, it was very fun and a bit of a relief to talk about someone else's art for a change.
Well, now you get the spotlight.
Yes.
So tell us why you chose Continuum Alley as the site for Needles to Thread.
Well, to speak about Continuum Alley, I'll have to introduce a man named Del Seymour, who runs the Tenderloin Tours. He has a business where he brings people to the Tenderloin to show people what's up there. So I contacted Dell and I told him I was interested to see if there were any sweatshops there, because I had done some research on some Chinese women's history in the city that was a really groundbreaking bit of history in terms of a strike of Chinese women that led to breaking the color barrier in the city for garment worker shops. So I was interested to know, are there sweatshops here now? And Dell took me around. He introduced me to the people at the Tenderloin Community Benefit District, who then brought me to Continuum Alley. It's a very interesting place because it's bordered by a labor hall, Local 2. It's bordered by Dataway, which is a securities company in the Tenderloin that's been incredibly generous to us. It's bordered by a bunch of lofts, and it's bordered by regular people housing, apartments that regular people live in. And two blocks away is an active sweatshop.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So tell us about the garment industry history in San Francisco.
Well, I don't know the full breadth of the whole history, but I, when I became interested in looking at women's economic issues, I'm always interested in a historical lens. So I contacted LARC, the Labor Archives and Research Center, who's a long-term collaborator of mine, and they introduced me to several different bits of women's history in the city, and I became really interested in this one strike. It happened in 1938 at the National Dollar Store, which no longer exists. But it was the first time that Chinese women organized. It was the first time that Chinese women organized in context with a white union. At that point, the unions were very racially segregated in the 30s. And as I said, it was a significant strike, not so much for the outcome. The women were on strike for 105 days, and while they did win the strike, they were striking for better wages. The National Dollar Store closed within a year. So it wasn't such a win in the minuscule, but it was a win in the larger sense that it really connected Chinese women to the larger labor movement in the city and, as I said, to breaking the color line in other shops around the city. And, you know, looking in this moment in 2015 at income distribution, it's really important to me to look through a feminist lens on that. And according to the New York Times, 70% of the people in poverty are women. And then, of course, we have to put a race lens on that, because what white women experience is not necessarily the same as what black women experience, is not the same as what Asian women experience, et cetera. So that 70% is kind of an aggregate number. But this particular strike was for me a way into the issue. And because I'm a choreographer and not a historian and not a policy person, the thing that was so interesting was that garment work is by nature a very visual field. It's a very visual thing. You've got the sewing machines, you've got cloth, all these things that really lend themselves to theatricality. And so with the genius of Sean Riley, who's our set designer, and really the genius of our whole artistic team, from our production staff all the way through to the dancers, who've been incredibly innovative and had really great stamina for this project because it's very difficult. Anyway, we've all come together to really transform this alley into something that reflects the history and the issue as it is currently.
Tell us what we're going to see in that alley, then.
The alley is a really difficult alley. It was the very first site of needle exchange in the city. And that's part of why I titled the show Needles to Thread. It's more difficult than I even knew when we started. It's basically a place where a lot of people go either to shoot up or to use the bathroom where there is no bathroom. There's just a lot of curb. So it's a difficult place. It is the essence of American failure, in my opinion. We clean the alley every single day in order to work there. That's the only way we could work there, because the stench and the danger with a lot of needles around. So we clean it up. When an audience comes, it'll be all clean. Don't worry. But I think it's important to give the context of what the alley is. But what you'll see is a very transformed space. I think more so than any of the other trilogy, we've achieved a level of physical and imaginative transformation that I'm just so proud of. You'll see a fire escape turned into an assembly line via these large, oversized sewing machines. You'll see the dresses come to life. The dresses start hanging on clotheslines, and then the dancers wear the dresses, and then they come to life. And my question really was, well, what would the dresses say about their experience in these sweatshops, as if they could see, as if they could report?
Almost like ghosts coming back.
Exactly. And I kind of use the images of the 12 dancing princesses, where, you know, everyone goes to bed at night, and then the dresses come alive and dance all night. So that was one of the sort of light images that we worked with.
Well, how many dancers slash acrobats, because they really have to be trained in that and acrobatics for your work, that's for sure. How many will we see?
There's seven women in the project. Mm-hmm. An amazingly well-rounded cast, very multi-ethnic cast, which is something I wanted, because, you know, when you talk about the garment industry, you talk about it in the United States, and it's one thing, and it's one thing that's very diminished here because of NAFTA. But because of NAFTA, the garment scene overseas, especially in South Asia, is really explosive and deeply unregulated and deeply difficult for the women who are in the industry. So it's the piece has both a local lens and inevitably an international sense as well.
Tell us about the music that Teresa Wong has created for this project.
Well, I've spent the last 20 years commissioning women composers, and that's something that I'm really proud of as a choreographer. It's not a cheap thing to do. It's pretty pricey to commission original music pretty consistently, but I feel like one of the things that we do as an organization is to raise women's voices, and so it's been really fun for me over 20 years to work with all these women composers. And Teresa is new to me this year, and she's been so both grounded and imaginative in what she's done. We knew that the history of this project was based in Chinese women's experience, so she chose the halusi, which is a Chinese horned instrument, and so that's a really big feature in a section that you're not going to play. And then we together interviewed Tina Chen, who's one of the lead organizers in Local 2, and she's also a former garment worker. So we were able to mine her experience in the industry and hear her perspective as someone who has organized herself and many of her colleagues out of some of the difficulties in the industry.
Well, let's talk a little bit more after we hear some of the music of Teresa Wong, and we'll also hear the voice of Tina Chen in this excerpt from Joe Kreider's Needles to Thread.
So at that time, you know, when I came, I did not know English. I don't speak English. There's no any language skill to look for a decent work in Chinatown area. Right. So the most easy job find is the seamstress. So at that time, it's kind of like hot, this hot job. So I remember at that time, the minimum wages was $3.35. But I cannot make $3.35 per hour. And I'm making dollar or less a dollar per hour.
That's the voice of former garment worker Tina Chen, incorporated into the soundtrack of Teresa Wong's music for Joe Kreider's production Needles to Thread in the Alley at on Golden Gate Avenue and the Continuum Alley. Joe, that's some neat stuff to work with.
You mean the sound?
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, Tina gave a really great context to what we were doing because her experience is in the present, though, she made the choice to switch from being a garment worker to being a hotel worker, and then she's worked her way up the chain. She's actually one of the highest-ranking Asian-American women in the labor community in the city. So she's really worked hard, and she's also got a real sense of organizing as a way to change things, and that's kind of what the piece ends on.
This is the third of a trilogy. Is there a reason why you chose three works to round this out?
Well, I wanted to try some depth with the topic. I felt like one piece wasn't going to do it. I wanted to spend 5 years in the Tenderloin. I thought, well, let me set myself up for a long-term relationship with the neighborhood rather than a one-off. And that's been really satisfying. I mean, there are people that I walk down the street and they recognize me because they saw something that happened on the Renoir Hotel, or they saw Multiple Mary at UC Hastings. So that's a very satisfying thing. And, you know, it gave me the opportunity to have some depth with the content. I feel like income inequality is the, you know, the essence of America's problems right now.
And we're the pinnacle of it here, the epicenter.
Well, we are in a funny way. I mean, the collision of wealth and poverty is so apparent in the Tenderloin. And even in Continuum Alley, where you have Dataway, which is this very thriving business, and then right outside their door is this difficult place. And so we actually, Dataway has allowed us to enter their building to take a break from the alley during the whole creative process, and we really needed it. There were times when we were just, and I was particularly just really overwhelmed by the feces and the urine and the needles and the people coming in just in so much pain and having a sense of personal space that's so small that they would simply turn their body 10 degrees and imagine they were alone and use that alone space, quote unquote, to get out their needles and do their thing.
Wow.
So it's really hard to watch that kind of pain, you know, multiple times a day. So Dataway gave us an oasis, and I feel like they have a very excellent relationship with the neighborhood in terms of trying to be part of the solution for things and not isolating themselves and turning their backs against the neighborhood.
These performances start tonight, but you mentioned that you're incorporating yourself into the neighborhood. This was preceded by a 9-week residency in Continuum Alley.
Exactly.
So, and what sort of things were going on other than your rehearsing? and the aforementioned interesting modes of personal habit.
Well, a lot of people use the alley as a place to sleep. There's a certain point in the day where the sun is off the alley, and so it's shaded, and it's been really hot these last 9 weeks. So people come and sleep. They bring their cardboard. They bring, you know, something that allows them some sense of home, and plop it down on the curb and lay down and go to sleep. So, you know, sometimes we'd have to ask them, can you just move down the alley 10 feet so we don't hit you with one of our ropes? And people were very courageous and interested. And there's this one woman who seemed pretty difficult space in general. And she, we were in the alley doing something, and she said, I'm sorry, I'm in your way. And I said, this isn't our alley, this is your alley. So, you know, no need to apologize. And she wasn't actually in our way. She just had nowhere to go. So it's a place that people come and rest. Get a little bit of privacy because it's off the hullabaloo of Golden Gate. And sometimes I need that privacy for rest, for taking a break, and sometimes for things that are a little bit more difficult.
Mm. Well, it sounds like it's been rewarding in many ways in terms of a different perspective on life for you and the company.
I think challenging is a better word.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that watching that day in and day out is a reward.
I feel like
it's a challenge and a call to action. And, you know, that's what we've tried to do. There's also, at the end of the alley, is the gateway into these apartments where several families live. So we watch children walk through the alley every day. And what do they see? And what do we want them to see? And so that's where I feel really proud of the transformation that we've done there, and that the show is free and anybody can come see it. Though I have to say, there is limited capacity. It's not like our other projects where we can have 500 or 600 people per show. So do get there early, and we are giving out tickets. So there's no charge for the tickets, but we do have a limited number of people who can actually physically be in the alley.
Thanks for taking some time today, Joe. Joe Kreider's Needles to Thread runs twice each evening at 8 p.m. and 9 p.m., Thursday to Saturday, October 1st to 3rd, and the same from October 8th to the 10th. Seating is limited and available for each 30-minute performance. And at 7 p.m. each Saturday, the Labor Archives and Research Center will host a walking tour focusing on the neighborhood's most important sites of labor history. For more information, flyawayproductions.com. Thanks for coming in today, Joe.
Thank you so much.
That's music of Dan Cantrell, who will be performing live here in studio shortly. His music is heard of in Unheard of World at the Exit Theater. What do you get when you combine the stories of a 200,000-year-old man, a girl half swallowed by a bear, a little boy who refused to be born, and a woman yearning even in death to have a child? Well, you get The Unheard of World, a dark and eccentric fantasy penned by playwright Fabrice Melchiot in 2011, translated from the French by Fool's Fury Company member Michelle Hainer. It's at the Exit Theater on Eddy Street, opening tomorrow. She joins me in studio today. Michelle has been a member of Fool's Fury since 2007 and oversees the company's French Plays project, dedicated to the translation and production of new French contemporary theater. With training at Harvard, the Sorbonne, UCLA, and L'École Jacques Lecoq in Paris, she brings a rich background to her work in the theater, as well as to the arts department at the French American International School in San Francisco, which she is head of. Acting and directing intermingle in her resume as well, and TV credits include CSI, Dragnet, Deadwood, and One on One. Welcome, Michelle.
Hi, nice to be here.
She's joined by accordionist, pianist, saw player Dan Cantrell, who won an Emmy Award for his score for Homefront and Hope on the Streets, which was a PBS documentary about gentrification here in the San Francisco Bay Area. He provides the musical score for the play. Recent collaborators include, among others, Tom Waits, the San Francisco Symphony, members of the Klezmatics, as well as Brave Old World and Fishbone, among others. Welcome to you, Dan.
Thank you.
Michelle, the play is translated from the French. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm wondering of any issues or problems with that, including probably some cultural differences.
Sure. Well, it's really interesting because I've been in recent days so deep in directing the play instead of translating it that I've been in this other sort of problems of translation, which is how to take the world of Melchiot off the page and much more into the space. You know, where to some extent the actors are worrying about everything except the text, like the emotional world, the physical world, the lights, the sound, the set. So it's funny to be, oh, yeah, those problems of the text and that translation. And it's true, Melchiot's world, I'll confess, in the French, it is so rich and poetic, and there's such a pleasure in the French language that this was very much sort of what attracted me to the world. And offers up lots of challenges of translation. And what I would say is, it is, you know, if you were to hear it in the French, you would have a different musicality and a different sensibility. And yet, I would say that, like, in the juiciness of the images, there's a real invitation to kind of find equivalents in English or find playfulness in English. I'm going to give a very small example, which is there's a moment when the no child, the child who doesn't want to be born, says, "Ne regardez pas mon zizi," which is wonderfully sort of French and irreverent, you know. And I said, you know, what could be an equivalent to zizi, which is so French and playful and has this wonderful resonance to it? And I came up with, you know, "Don't look at my ding-a-ling." So it's different in English, but how to find some equivalent. And there are some chunks where Melchiot plays so much with the French or these plays on the words that there are some that I actually simply kept in French because there was a real mixture of language in the play. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's these questions of some things will be lost in translation and maybe some things will be discovered in translation.
Mm-hmm. And how native is French to your tongue? Is it a solid second language for you? Were you brought up in the French language?
I am not a native French speaker. I first went there when I was 14 years old, not speaking a word of French, and was plunged into a middle school. I sort of fell in love with France and French then. I spent most of my 20s in France and have studied French as an actress and as sort of an academic at the Sorbonne. So I'm very familiar with French. I love French. I have a sensibility for the language, but I'm not a native speaker. I actually do not translate from English into French. So my real sort of at-home language is English, but my affection and maybe kind of my secondhand appreciation of French, I think maybe allows me to be very attuned to it with almost this sort of outside eye. But really, in terms of rendering it into another language, I work in my native language of English,
sure.
And I wouldn't translate in the other direction.
Sure. Now, let's talk a little bit about Fabrice Melchior and his work. He was born in 1972. Have you met him? Have you talked with him at all about this particular work? And when did you first encounter him?
So I first met him through Ben Yalom and Fool's Fury. I just want to sort of acknowledge that Ben Yalom, the founding artistic director of Fool's Fury, he and I met in France and have sort of a shared love of French theater and the sort of connections between America and France. And Ben Yalom actually directed in 2006 the U.S. premiere of Fabrice Melchior's Devil on All Sides. And Fabrice Melchior did come out for that production. And that was actually where I met Fabrice. And then from there, with the French Plays Project, we read a whole number of other plays by Fabrice Melchior and chose this one and another play, Albatross, for translation. And then I had quite a lot of email correspondence with Fabrice at the time of translation around certain words and phrases. But I haven't actually met him in person since I saw him in 2006 with The Devil on All Sides.
Is he coming to the premiere perhaps, or maybe he'll
No. He is directing a company, actually a theater in Switzerland, so isn't able to come out for the premiere. But he knows about it and sort of sends his blessings from afar.
Dan Cantrell also joins Michelle Hainer in studio. Dan, what kind of inspiration does a composer get from what is described as a dark and eccentric fantasy? A lot, I imagine.
Yeah. I mean, it was. I didn't know, Michelle, if you knew this, but I did the music for Devil on All Sides, too.
I did know that. I know that was part of why Dan, why Ben originally suggested the collaboration. Yeah.
But it was actually really neat to hear the translations because of exactly what Michelle was saying. It doesn't come across exactly, and it's nice fodder for lyrics, I think. So I've gotten to write these songs, you know, with just the lyrics being a little off, and I like the world that this is in. I mean, most of his, at least with The Devil on All Sides and Unheard of World, it's very murky, kind of lugubrious kind of stuff, and it has a lot of exciting things, you know, where it's not from one place or the other, you know.
So with that introduction, as our radio audience can see, you've got an accordion strapped around your body here.
Really?
Oh my gosh.
How did that happen?
With that introduction, we've got to hear some music from it. Would you be so kind as to?
Sure. I'll play the theme song that I wrote for this Unheard of World.
Okay, great.
There's a plaster cast of beauty, there's a plaster cast of sin. The ending's cast in plaster before we can begin. And every foolish grin is cast in gypsum and in clay. Unheard of world, unheard of world. There's a woman in the corner, wilting day by day. There's no love beneath this soil, left only to decay. If I could only touch your lips with memories above ground. Unheard of world, unheard of world, unheard of world, unheard of. Dum 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 da dum. Da 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 da. Unheard of world, unheard of world.
Beautiful stuff. Boy, a live performance by Emmy Award composer Dan Cantrell, who's providing the music for Unheard of World, obviously the title song there from the Fool's Fury Theater Company's presentation of the North American premiere of The Unheard of World by Fabrice Melchior. Great, Dan. I'm looking forward to that. Boy.
Thank you.
And I understand, Michelle, that the performers are actually, the actors are actually singing some of these songs as part of the soundtrack, the live soundtrack as well.
Yeah. So they're singing actually both this, the song that... that Dan just sang leads us into the production, and there's another very beautiful song, much more melancholic and poignant, that leads us into the second act. Also, while Dan has composed a soundtrack, so there's a lot of music that is actually pre-recorded, there's also a lot of live Foley happening, so moments when the actors play, you know, little pieces of music or song or introduce other instrumentation. Yeah.
The play itself runs through, let's see, it runs until, how long is the run? I don't have an end.
So through October 31st, through Halloween.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and it's a kind of great sort of a Halloween show, I'm going to say, for younger people, but also for grown-ups.
A surreal tale for, and a macabre treat for adults and children alike, it's being called. So
yeah.
It's the storyline sounds so bizarre and wonderful as well.
Yeah. Yeah, there's also a side to it, which is really, I think, sort of provocative and poignant, this idea that everybody who dies literally goes underground. So we're in this sort of packed, you know, overpopulated underworld full of different nationalities. To some extent, it's a sort of dark look maybe into the future with all of the problems and opportunities that brings up.
Very nice. Dan, could we be entertained by perhaps an excerpt of another tune from
sure.
the show?
And then I mean, I can play one of the other ones that's sung as well. I recorded it with a different instrumentation, but I'm sure it'll sound interesting on accordion too.
Okay, let's hear it. Yeah.
I will forget you. Just take one look in my eye. A touch on your forehead slips from memory, living or dead, erase you like drift snow covers your trace. So gently turning till no one remembers your face, I will forget you. We will forget you. We'll forget you. This is our kindness for you.
Live performance by Dan Cantrell. Some of the music you'll hear in Unheard of World. Thanks again for that, Dan.
Pleasure.
Have a great run on this show. It's Fool's Fury Theater Company and the North American premiere of The Unheard of World, translated from the French by Michelle Hayner with original music by Dan Cantrell. Previews on tomorrow evening at 8 and then runs through October 31st. Information at foolsfury.org/world. Michelle, Dan, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Of course. Soprano Susanna Phillips returns to Davies Symphony Hall today, Friday and Saturday, for concerts with the San Francisco Symphony under the direction of Michael Tilson Thomas. I caught up with her after her rehearsal there Tuesday afternoon. Susanna, welcome back to Davies Symphony Hall.
Hello, I'm glad to be back.
Where in 2012 you had your symphonic debut with MTT for Mahler's Fourth.
That's right. Actually, I came here the year before. I was here for New Year's Eve. We did the New Year's Eve gala here, but my debut with Michael Tilson Thomas was Mahler 4 last year, which was an extraordinary experience. I'm not sure I'll ever forget the third movement that they played. It was beautiful.
Now, this piece, Barber's Knoxville Summer of 1915, was written in 1947 mm-hmm. at the request of Serge Koussevitzky for full orchestra, and he later rewrote it in several ways, and this performance we'll hear tonight is one of the smaller ensemble versions. Is that right?
That's right, but it is a larger ensemble. There's an excuse me. There's an additional version that's for a smaller group, but yes, this is for a slightly larger chamber music ensemble.
Barber studied at Curtis and was quite accomplished as a baritone. Do you think that that had a lot of influence on his writing for the voice? Do you feel his own powers of as a vocalist come through in the score?
Absolutely. I think this is one of the best written pieces for the voice because he knew what he was talking about. He could sing the whole thing and really sing it in a beautiful way. Barber's songs and chamber works are some of the easiest to sing in the sense that the settings of them are so vocally appropriate. They are challenging in many, many other ways, but they're not challenging simply for the sake of being challenging. Some people who try and write for the voice but aren't familiar with the specifics, the specific needs of the instrument, make it much more difficult than it needs to be. And he really just gets out of the way and lets you do what you need to do, and I appreciate that.
Well, just hearing the rehearsal, you're articulating it beautifully. It comes across both with the orchestration and your extraordinary diction.
Thank you. For me, this piece is very personal. I grew up about 3 hours away from Knoxville, Tennessee. I grew up in Huntsville, Alabama. And so all of the images that he refers to in this piece, I can recall very vividly in my own imagination and my own memory. And so I take it to heart, and it's important to me personally to get these words as clearly across, both in diction and in color, so that we're able to evoke the memories in the way that I remember them, at least.
It's funny you should mention that, because the folks that were originally associated with the piece back when it was first composed, from Barber himself to even Leontine Price, even though they grew up in different towns, they have that same kind of small-town nostalgic memory that they're bringing to the piece.
It's interesting. I'm not sure it really matters that it's in Knoxville. I think almost any small town in America could relate to this scene of a hot summer evening with people lazily enjoying the summer evening together as a family. I think that's universal throughout America.
You're obviously of a different generation than Knoxville summer of 1915, but even with rose-colored glasses, the nostalgia is so evident. Now, from Huntsville, but a thoroughly modern girl from Huntsville, I imagine.
I am a thoroughly modern girl from Huntsville, and I actually am a New Yorker now. I recently got married, and my husband and I live in New York, so I can't claim being a New Yorker. Actually, we just came home from our honeymoon, and on our way home, we honeymooned in Europe, and on our way home, we were going through security at the airport, and they asked me where I came from, where my home was, and I said, Alabama. And he elbowed me and he said, no, you're from New York now. And it was kind of a funny moment.
Well, congratulations on the honeymoon and the wedding. I understand that he proposed to you just after your appearance here in 2012 at the Mahler.
That's right. He came and saw three performances of Mahler's Fourth Symphony, and he's quickly becoming an avid classical music fan, though he hasn't had a very long exposure to it. And so that for him was quite the show of devotion. And after the last performance, we drove up the coast, and he proposed to me that evening.
Very sweet. Now, you're going to be in your eighth consecutive year appearing at the Met this season as Rosalinda and Fledermaus, and back again as Musetta, appearing in opera houses all over the world. Are you trying to balance those kinds of full operatic roles with more chamber, more symphonic appearances?
I try very hard to have kind of a threefold approach to my schedule and my career, because I feel like each informs the other. Each has their own merits. A performance like this, with as a concert version with the orchestra, a concert performance with orchestra, is very important to me. I feel like I'm able to express myself individually and with a full orchestra. However, performing with a pianist alone in a recital is equally important, because you find a lot of subtleties and a lot of nuances that you're not necessarily able to achieve with a larger group of people, or it takes a lot more time and a lot more focus to achieve those same kind of nuances. At the same time, you're not able to bring across the impact that an opera brings across, that tells the story with costumes and scenery and props and a full orchestra, and it really makes a tremendous impact on an audience member. So for me, it's very important to keep all three alive and to keep learning from all three experiences.
How far out is your schedule projected at this point? I know opera singers have to do this many, many seasons in advance. From here, you go to Sydney to sing the Beethoven Missa Solemnis. Are you going to have some downtime there, perhaps, down under?
I wish. I've never been to Australia. It's my first time, and I wish I would have some downtime, but I'm only going to be there for the few rehearsals and then the performances, and then I'll fly back to start. Actually, I'm doing the Philos Requiem at Carnegie Hall soon after, so I have to prepare for that. But, yeah, I try and keep my schedule booked sort of about 3 years in advance, with enough space to allow for other opportunities that come later.
So lots of wonderful Mozart in your repertory. I'm wondering if there's some other new roles you're looking forward to adding.
Oh, goodness. Mozart-wise or in general?
General.
In general, I would say there are many roles that I'd like to revisit throughout the years. Something like Violetta and Traviata, I think, is very fascinating to sing as a young person, a middle-aged person, and even a slightly older person. I'd be interested to kind of explore that part. A part that I look forward to singing one day is the Marschallin from Rosenkavalier, just because she's such a fascinating character to me, and I would very much love to sing that trio. Goodness gracious.
Stunning music. Oh, my gosh.
It's amazing. There is not music like that anywhere else in the repertoire. So.
Well, speaking of Samuel Barber, have you sung Vanessa, or would you like to add Vanessa to your role?
I would love to add Vanessa to my role. I know it's very rarely done. I know Santa Fe Opera is doing it next summer, but I am not familiar with any other company that's performing it right now, and I love that opera very much. It has a beautiful quintet in it that's stunning, and I would love to take a look at that part.
Well, the great Stephanie Blythe just concluded a stint next door at the San Francisco Opera House as Mrs. Lovett and Sweeney Todd's Sondheim Sweeney Todd. Conducted by Patrick Summers, who you just worked with in Aspen, to fabulous reviews. Do you have any interest in the musical theater on opera stage aspect of your career?
Of course I do. I grew up with that stuff, and I love that music. So for me, it's incredible, and I would love to do it. And a lot of that music, especially before 1960, was intended to be sung without amplification anyway. So it makes sense that it would be a classical singer who approached it. And I know, you know, Heidi Stober and Brian Mulligan are also excellent in that show, and I loved here. I actually caught that show the other night, and I really loved seeing them bring this incredible Sondheim score to life with real musical integrity. It was wonderful and beautifully acted.
So a quick check of the San Francisco Opera Archives didn't have your name anywhere. I'm hoping that we'll see you at the Opera House at some point in the near future. Anything coming up?
I would love to sing here, and I really hope that something comes through. And we're talking about something, but I can't quite make it public yet.
Well, you can make public that you're going to be one of the many runners in the New York City Marathon this fall. How was preparation for that in between all of your appearances?
It's been fun. I have been trying to run. I spent this past summer in Santa Fe, which has a very high altitude. So running there was quite the difficult preparation, but I think it served me well. Unfortunately, I guess fortunately I got married. Unfortunately, we took a wonderful 2-week honeymoon on a boat. So I have lapsed a little bit in my mileage. So I'm trying to ramp it up here for the next month before the marathon.
Well, I wish you a great timing and a great time here in San Francisco. We look forward to having you back.
Thank you. I love my time here every time I come. So I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you.
Let's hear a bit of that dress rehearsal from Tuesday. Here is soprano Susanna Phillips and an excerpt from Barber's Knoxville, summer of 1915.
Thank you.
an excerpt from the dress rehearsal on Tuesday, live from Davies Symphony Hall, soprano Susanna Phillips, and Barbers, the Knoxville summer of 1915. Michael Tilson Thomas conducting the San Francisco. The symphony is also including composer Ted Hearn's Dispatches, which is a San Francisco Symphony co-commission, and Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony. Info for the performances, one of which starts at 2 o'clock this afternoon, with additional performances on Friday and Saturday evening at 8, are at the symphony's website, sfsymphony.org. Peter Robinson joins me next here on Open Air with a couple of interesting film reviews. Hello, Peter.
Hi, David. Good to be here. And I was just thinking before I speak about the movies, listening to that accordion playing took me back to a memory of sitting at a Boulevard Café in Paris, sipping my coffee, and out of nowhere, these two Americans came by, both with open suitcases full of Bibles, and there was a French person sitting next to me who may never have spoken English whatsoever, and the accordion player was playing in the background, and the American said straight away to this Frenchman, he says, "Do you know Jesus?" And the Frenchman says, "Oh," he says, "I know lots about French Jesus, but I know nothing about American Jesus." And I just thought to myself straight away, that is probably the best answer I've heard for one of those.
That's a great, I always, what a friend we have in Jesus. I love Jesus. Yeah, exactly.
How about one more toke over the line? So my first review this week comes live from the National Theatre in London. It's a very interesting technique they've developed over the last couple of years where they film inside the theatre. And you get that sense, and this is now playing both at the Kabuki and at the Lark in Marin County, so there's only two cinemas that carry these. It's a different type of photography, and you feel you're in the theatre while the play is going on. And in fact, sometimes you get better shots of both the actors and the conversations because the camera follows them. So the play is called The Beau Stratagem. It's by the Irish playwright George Farquhar. It was written in 1707, so it's part of what they call Restoration drama. And it is a romp, it's full of action, very funny, and strangely topical for today's world. And I should just say a short thing about Restoration drama. We're talking about that period in England after Oliver Cromwell and the Puritans left power. And the consequence was that you wanted some type of extravaganza, something to oppose the Puritanism when the theatres had been closed. So this particular play is about two con men visiting London, leaving London, and then going to the countryside in pursuit of a wealthy widow, so they would get both the money and the woman. It's very funny. The two main characters, played by Samuel Barnett and Geoffrey Stretfield, really bring action to this romp. And worth noting is the background music. It was written specially for this production. It's got a kind of Irish lilt to it. George Farquhar himself came from Londonderry. He actually wrote the play when he was 30 years old and dying. And I think it's a remarkable achievement that a play in this case, which is about both feminism and divorce, and has a good storyline going through it, relates in many ways to today's topics and today's trends. I highly recommend calling both the theatres because it does not play on a regular basis. It's called NTL, which stands for National Theatre Live, and the women in the cast are particularly strong. So the scene opens at the beginning in an inn in Lichfield, and the two con men are playing in the story two different roles, that one plays an aristocrat and the other plays his manservant or butler, and suddenly you're into this drama of what is true and what, in fact, is reality. And his chat-up line to the barmaid, I'm going to call her a barmaid because she is the innkeeper's daughter, is, "Good night, saucebox." And suddenly you realise that you're in a strange world where both the actors are now playing interesting con men. So don't miss The Beau Stratagem at the Lark Theatre and the Kabuki in San Francisco.
Thank you, Peter. And other cultural happenings that are going on these days that you've been involved in, anything you'd like to share?
Yeah, so my second choice is a thriller, highly recommended. It's called Sicario, and it is the drug, really a drug smuggling story, which I think anybody working in Homeland Security would be wise to watch, because this is an operation where a combination of a covert op and the FBI are actually operating beyond American control over the border in Mexico. Emily Blunt plays the FBI agent, and she plays a very down-to-earth. When it got reviewed at the Cannes Film Festival, they said it was strange to see her out of high heels. So there she is, galloping around with a really good cast. Josh Brolin plays the man running the operation, and suddenly you're in a world of tunnels, you're under the border going into Mexico, and then you suddenly find that assassins are looming everywhere. I would use the word haunting. This is a thriller that stayed with me for several couple of days after the film, and I think it raises what I call moral or ethical questions. Do you have to break the law, even if you're working with the FBI, to get the criminal? And I think that sort of philosophy behind this makes it a really intriguing thriller, which is beautifully shot. The director, Denis Villeneuve, Canadian, I think has brought an outsider's touch. So if you're looking for a good thriller this week, running at cinemas both here in the city and around the Bay Area, Sicario comes with my top recommendation.
Thank you, Peter, and we'll hear from you again down the road.
Okay, good to see you, David.
Well, Frank Sinatra Jr. was to have called into the studio for today's edition of Open Air. There was a bit of a confusion as to time zone and time. So I'll be pre-recording that interview next hour, which you'll hear on next week's Open Air. Sorry for any confusions on that. And look forward to that conversation with Frank Jr. Interesting birthday happens today, though. Dame Julie Elizabeth Andrews, born this date in 1935, a stage actress, singer, author, theater director, and dancer. She was a former child actress and singer, appeared on the West End back in 1948, and made her Broadway debut in a 1954 production of The Boyfriend. Well, you'll probably remember her as she rose to prominence in musicals such as My Fair Lady and Camelot, both of which earned her Tony Award nominations. In 1957, she appeared on television with the title role in the musical Cinderella, which was seen by over 100 million viewers. Julie made her feature film debut in Mary Poppins in 1964, for which she won the Academy Award for Best Actress. She received her second Academy Award nomination for The Sound of Music in 1965 and won the Golden Globe Award for Best Actress in a Musical. Happy birthday to Julie Andrews. And how appropriate during Open Air to play one of her most memorable songs, My Favorite Things, from The Sound of Music. My Favorite Things was a theme song that Alan Farley, my predecessor, used to use for his show called My Favorite Things. Here it is in its original flavor.
Raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens, bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens, brown paper packages tied up with strings. These are a few of my favorite things. Cream-colored ponies and crisp apple strudels, doorbells and sleigh bells and schnitzel with noodles, wild geese that fly with the moon on their wings. These are a few of my favorite things. Girls in white dresses with blue satin sashes, snowflakes that stay on my nose and eyelashes, silver-white winters that melt into springs. These are a few of my favorite things. When the dog bites, when the bee stings, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember my favorite things, and then I don't feel so bad. Raindrops drops on roses and whiskers on kittens, bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens, brown paper packages tied up with strings. These are a few of my favorite things. Green-colored ponies and crisp apple strudels, doorbells and sleigh bells and schnitzel with noodles, wild geese that fly with a moon on their wings. These are a few of my favorite things. Girls in white dresses with blue satin sashes, snowflakes that stay on my nose and eyelashes, silver-white winters that melt into springs. These are a few of my favorite things. When the dog bites, when the bee stings, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember my favorite things, and then I don't feel so bad.
Happy birthday to Julie Andrews. Hope you heard that, Alan Farley, wherever you might be. I'm David LaTulipe. You've been listening to Open Air on this, the first day of October 2015. My thanks to Neil Swinkles for greasing the wheels of Open Air with guests and calendar and such. If you've got a segment you'd like to hear promoted on Open Air, some special performing arts group, by all means, let me know. Send me an email, david@kalw.org. And a reminder also that this show, as well as all of our past shows, are archived at our website, kalw.org. And do tune in next week when I'll have that talk with Frank Sinatra Jr., and as well as some other local guests that are appearing here in the Bay Area. Thanks for listening this week to Open Air.